One of the hardest parts of getting older is feeling like something's off in your body, but not knowing exactly what. It's not just aging. It's often your hormones, too. When they fall out of balance, everything feels off. But here's the good news. This doesn't have to be the story of your next chapter. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is an herbal formula made with science-backed ingredients designed to fine-tune your hormones by balancing estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol. It helps with common issues such as hot flashes, poor sleep, low energy, bloating, and more. With over 40,000 reviews and a bottle sold every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. A survey found 86% of women lost weight, 77% saw an improved mood, and 100% felt like themselves again. Start your next chapter feeling balanced and in control. For a limited time, get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com with code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today. And get your old self back naturally.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Hey guys, welcome to this very special holiday edition of TFL Car Chat. And today we're going to have a really interesting show, Tommy, because you got a list of 100 cars that we drove this year? Jeepers, creepers, that's a lot. I didn't realize we drove that many cars.
And this is only the new cars we drove this year. So it was a huge year in 2024. We had a bunch of really high interest cars that we actually got behind the wheel of. There were some really big reveals this year. And in this video, we're gonna tell you some of our highlights, the best cars we drove, and some of the letdowns in the new car world. We're also gonna talk about some of our fleet updates, some of the cars that we've owned that turned out to be really good, maybe not so good, and everything in between.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a crazy year, and a lot of these cars are actually electric. And sometimes, I said this in the truck podcast, but sometimes people think that we're promoting electric cars over internal combustion engine or vice versa. And the fact is, we kind of follow the cadence of whatever the new thing is, right? The manufacturers have released a lot more electric stuff this year than in the past year. So if we're covering a lot of electric stuff, it's not because we're pushing electric, it's because that's the new it vehicle. At least this year.
And some of the EVs we drove are really good, some of them not so good, and we'll tell you all about that in today's list. So should we dive right in?
You want to start with the EVs, or how have you categorized that list?
I've just basically lumped it into some of the most impressive cars. They're not in any rhyme or reason, but I think it'll be a nice mix of both. So we're going to start with something that is definitively not an EV. This is a car we actually bought in January of this year. It's a car that we had a lot of seat time with, and that is the 2024 Ford Mustang GT.
Yeah, you know, that's a good one. I think in all this clatter about EVs, people have forgotten that the Mustang is the last pony car, muscle car standing, right? Camaro is gone until the new Hurricane-powered Charger comes along. That's gone, but the Mustang is still out there, and there is a whole bunch of different variations. In typical TFL fashion, we bought the cheapest GT we could afford, which was just over $40,000. I got to tell you, I got mixed feelings about that car. First and foremost, we did something very right, and I would highly recommend if you guys are looking at a Mustang GT, get the performance exhaust. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, that thing worth every penny. You start it up and it's got the most raucous, the most entertaining, the most fulfilling V8 sound probably I've heard the whole year. And you can, with the performance exhaust, you can actually make it louder or softer. So if you don't want to be scaring your neighbors when you're getting up in the morning and driving to work, you can start it and make it quiet. Or if you do hate your neighbors, you can like get the full-throated V8. But the problem with getting kind of the cheapest GT is we also got the cheap suspension.
I completely disagree.
Okay.
The car you want in the Mustang lineup is not the performance pack.
Yep.
It's not the dark horse. It's the base GT. Because the Mustang, in my opinion, can be made into a handling machine if you get like the super crazy Shelbys. But if you can't afford a Shelby, just get the comfy cruiser. That car had the best ride. It had these little 18-inch wheels with these fat sidewalls. It had the non-adaptive suspension, which kind of rode like a Cadillac. It was awesome.
It was the ultimate GT car, Grand Tour, right?
It didn't handle worth a darn when you really started pushing it.
And when we got it on the drag strip, you were a little afraid after over 100 miles an hour it would start to get a little bit light.
For sure, but that is such a small percentage of the time that you spend in triple digits. And for 99% of the time of just going to the grocery store, you're going to love the non-performance pack seats. No Recaros, right? Nothing crazy like that. You're going to love the comfy ride and the small wheels and the fat tires. It was awesome. So I know you think it didn't handle very well, and I agree the standard car doesn't handle well, but for everyday driving, that's the one you want.
And if you really do want to go on the performance route, it is a big difference. I mean, when you put on the performance tires, performance suspension, I mean, it does make it much rougher riding, much more taunt. And if you like that kind of a sports car feel, then you should go for it. But I agree with you, Tommy. You know, if you just want to truck around and use it as a weekend cars and coffee car, get the base model like we did. The downside to that, though, is the interior is kind of a sea of cheap plastic materials.
Yeah, but I mean,
didn't you think the interior was a little?
It was cheap.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, right? I've driven some of the performance pack cars, and they do handle a lot better. But when you get them on a mountain road where they're supposed to shine, it's still not as light or nimble or as fun as like a GR86 or a Supra or a Miata. So just get the suspension that's tailored to the car. The interior is a little cheap, like you said, not really that big of a problem. We had the base interior with the two separate screens, not the one continuous screen under one pane of glass, and I think that was fine. The tech was actually really good. It's got the latest sync system, which worked incredibly well. Apple CarPlay.
It like seamlessly integrated with your phone.
Yeah, it was a great car. Heated seats, right? So not total base model. It had automatic climate control.
Big fat steering wheel, leather covered steering wheel, so that was nice. Didn't hold its value that well, though. It did depreciate. So I think we bought it for around, if I remember right, it was just over like $42,000, $43,000 because we did get a discount on it.
Uh-huh.
It was like a 48 sticker and then we got like $5,000 off. But I think when we traded it in with, you know, usually we hold them on for about what, how many miles? Probably close
10,000.
To 10,000. I think we got like 35 for it.
It's pretty good, actually. Mustang GTs generally hold their value fairly well. I mean, granted, that's a lot of depreciation, but it was also a trade-in, so we're not getting private party value. And I'm actually was pretty impressed with it. So I think as an all-around car, you want to go fast. That new-gen Coyote engine's insane. You want to make cool sounds. You want to look cool. It was just really, really
and
good.
The color was beautiful. We had that really kind of beautiful Ford blue. Really loved it. All right, what's next on your list, dude?
So the next car I drove that I really, really loved, which was just, I think, one of the highlights of the year in general, was the Lexus GX 550.
Yeah, so me and you actually went on the launch of that. We had a nice chat with the chief engineer. And I think as time has gone by, we're proving, and a lot of people I think would agree with this, that out of the two new Toyota off-roaders, the Land Cruiser and the GX, the play is a GX.
Sure.
Yeah, I think it's the one to go for. And there's a little caveat there, and that is the regular GX actually has a pretty harsh ride for a Lexus especially. So if you do want to get one, get the off-roady one because that has the thicker sidewalls, the more beefier tires, and it really kind of calms down the ride.
So the one you want is the standard Overtrail. There's also like an Overtrail Plus,
right,
which is full of all sorts of luxury features.
But get the Overtrail.
Standard Overtrail is the one you want to go for, but you get that twin turbo V6, which is, in my opinion, a lot more responsive than the hybrid system in the Land Cruiser. I also really like the interior more than the Land Cruiser for not that much more money. I mean, even if you get like the base GX 550, which is still an excellent car, it starts in the mid 60s. And realistically, any Land Cruiser you're going to find is going to be at the minimum low 60s, well into the 70s.
The first edition's in the 70s.
Yeah, if you get a first edition.
Yeah.
So I think just spend the slight extra coin for the GX. You get the twin turbo V6 instead of the four cylinder. You get a nicer interior. You get a vehicle that looks just as good. I think you get slightly more towing capacity as well. This seems to like mad at the upper ends. So really a very, very good car. Lexus leaned into the off-road space like they should have with the Overtrail, and they just nailed it.
Yeah, I have to be a journalist, Tommy, so I have to have something to complain about, right? My only complaint is that the interior, even though the materials are much nicer than, let's say, the Mustang, which is kind of a sea of plastics, they are kind of dark and drab. There's not a lot of like fizz on the interior. It needs a little bit more fizz.
My complaint is that they limit the third row to certain trims, which is a big mistake in my opinion, especially in that category.
You can't get the overtrail in the third row.
It'd be nice to have the 7-seat version across the line. That would expand its user base a little bit. But as a whole, Lexus just knocked the GX550 out of the park.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, sales are proving that point because they're hard to get.
Yeah, they are, and they're staying expensive.
Now, the question I have, of course, with the new 4Runner coming is, will the 4Runner actually, you know, bite into the sales of the GX? I know the two don't directly compete, but, you know, if you can't get a 4Runner and you don't, I mean, if you can't get a GX and you don't want a Land Cruiser, maybe the 4Runner is the way to go, especially if you get, like, the TRD Pro or, you know, the Trail Hunter version.
I think we're going to see a little bit of crossover,
yep.
But GX is a slightly different consumer base,
different dealership network. I mean, you know, Lexus versus Toyota, it is a big difference.
Slightly different.
Lot less Lexus. Come on, you're going to just have fun here.
I know, but I can't finish my sentence. Right, you got to let me finish my sentence.
Finish your sentence.
No, I just think it's a different person buying the 4Runner than the GX 550. Tows a lot less. Typically a smaller family. Typically, I mean, 4Runner starts in the 40s. GX starts in the mid-60s. So I think that's good. It's good stuff.
Yeah, I don't know what the move will be. We'll have to try the 4Runner and see. But right now, given the choice between the Land Cruiser and the GX, if you can do the GX, I would do the GX.
All right, next on the list of things that I really like that I drove this year is the new 2025 Toyota Camry.
Yeah, really phenomenal. One of the big things, of course, that they've done is they made every Camry a hybrid. So you're looking at what 10 years ago would have been Prius-like fuel economy numbers, and I'm talking like high 40s, low 50s out of a very big, very cushy, very comfortable family sedan.
Yeah, you can also get all-wheel drive now very easily in the Camry Hybrid.
Don't love the all-wheel drive in the Camry. Don't love it.
Why?
Isn't it the system where it has a little battery that powers the rear wheels, or is it does it come off the engine separate? Is there, in other words, what I'm saying, is there a drive shaft between the front of the Camry and the rear of the Camry, or is it electric?
So it is an all-wheel drive system, separate motor on the rear axle. It didn't do very well on the slip test compared to the old one, which was a little bit disappointing. However, it is still better than not having all-wheel drive at all.
Sure.
And I think that was a really good move that Toyota's making it so readily available. And it's better than like the old Prius system that had no torque at the rear end. But yeah, I mean, you talk about like mid to high 40 mpg range in a Camry with big backseat, big trunk, pretty good technology. It was just a really good value proposition from Toyota. I thought they did a really nice job.
Yeah, I mean, my criticism, like I said, of it is that when you see all-wheel drive or four-wheel drive, you think of something that becomes like a snow car or an off-roady car. Obviously, the Camry's an off-roady car, but that system does do a good job of, say, getting you going when you're stuck, but it's not as good as you know, a regular traditional four-wheel drive or all-wheel drive system. At least your slip test has proved that.
Yeah, but it's still pretty good.
Yeah, and the interior on it is spectacular.
I mean, I still think the car as a whole is a lot better than the old generation.
And it's affordable. It starts like, you know, mid-30s.
Mm-hmm.
And that interior, there's like a blood red interior or a leather, which is just spectacular. And to me, it was one of the cars I actually thought about buying for a long-term review because it's so phenomenally fuel efficient. But then again, so is the Accord. So the Japanese just keep like one-upping themselves, and it's good for all of us.
All right, so the next car I want to talk about on the list is a car that was one of my disappointments of the year. I'm going to kind of mix some of these in here as well. And that is the new Toyota Crown Signia.
Hmm.
So this is kind of the lifted station wagon crossover version of the Crown, is a good way of looking at it. And the reason I didn't like it is because it chopped up that Toyota crossover pie one too many times, and I felt like it didn't add that much of a value proposition over a standard Crown, over a RAV4, over a Highlander. It was very nice on the inside, certainly Lexus levels of quality, but it's also pretty expensive on the upper end. We're talking, in some cases, Lexus levels of price, so I just don't think it filled a need to the point that it needed to exist in the U.S.
Yeah, I know, it's weird, because there are certain cars that, like, segment defining, like if you think of a Tahoe, right, you know that's a truck-based SUV. Same thing with the Suburban. It's pretty obvious what that is. And then there are some cars that like bend what that segment is. So I'll give you an example. A good example of that is the Subaru Outback, right? Is that a station wagon or is it a crossover SUV? right? It could be either. It could be a tall wagon, or, and I kind of feel the same way about the Signia. Is it a tall sedan, or is it a crossover, or is it an SUV? And I think those cars come from a country that has a very aging demographic. And so what you're basically building are, like the Venza as well, you're building these, and that's what replaces the Venza, you're building these tall sedans, which make it easier for us old folk to get in and out of them, you know? So the seat height is much higher than a traditional sedan, and so it's easier to scoot in and out of the thing. And they're very popular in Japan. I don't know, man. Americans love their crossovers, and they love traditional crossovers. And when you start to kind of mix a sedan, a station wagon, a crossover, and you're not sure what it is, then I'm not sure the sales are going to be as strong as they are in Japan. I'm also not sure that now you're getting into the price range of a Lexus. So you could certainly buy a Lexus for what a Crown Signia costs. I mean, it's Toyota kind of flexing its luxury muscle, but isn't that where a Lexus should be and not a Toyota? That's my concern about it. I drove it with Andre. It drives well. It is everything that it says it is on the label. There's no surprises. And I guess that's good or bad.
Yep. So that's Crown Signia. I think we're in the same boat on that one.
Yeah.
Now, going back to cars we really liked this year, this was a car that I was very surprised about, and I don't think you're going to like this one. But I really enjoyed the new ND3 generation of the Mazda Miata. So some slight tweaks to the latest generation of ND Miata, but Mazda has always done this in various generations of Miata. Continual improvement. You start with a good platform and you tweak it a little bit, and ND3 brought in some really nice upgrades over the previous ND2 version. Some of the handling changes were really good. Some of the tech changes were really good, and it remains to be, I think, the most fun car on the market for the money. That thing is just such a great little sports car.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Miata is now at this point iconic, and I think the new one just carries on that tradition. I kind of wish Mazda would flex their engineering muscles and maybe do a hybrid or a plug-in hybrid.
Miata?
Yeah, in a Miata.
No, keep that for the boring crossover blobs. We still need the NA four-cylinder manual transmission. I don't think there's a want for that in the
market. Well, they tried the turbo. It didn't really sell.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, right.
And that wasn't a great turbo
no.
Actually, either, in the NB.
I mean, the problem with just this continual slow evolution is, if you've had one, I mean, you know, we owned, until, I think this year we sold our NC, I kind of feel like once you've been in one, you've been in all of them. And so there's no reason for me to like lust after the next generation, because I've kind of been there and done that. And so I would love to have a reason to go and like be like super fascinated. Remember we were at the Tokyo Motor Show last year, and they rolled out that basically it looked like an RX-8 or RX-7 retro designed. And that got me super excited, because I was like, wow, this is something new and something different from Mazda. The Miata, I've kind of been there, done that, and I wish they would do something interesting with it.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
When it comes to fungicides, there's only one way to spell yield. N-E-O. Miravis Neo is the 2024 number one retailer recommended corn fungicide for a reason. It dominates spots, rots, blights, and stress to out-yield competitive brands like Veltima. And there's 6 years of university data to prove it. Ask your Syngenta retailer about using Miravis Neo for more yield more often. Based on 2024 Stratus Retailer Efficacy Study. Always read and follow label instructions.
The problem is...
And it's also too small for me.
This is kind of like, the size thing has always been a problem with Miata. I will give you that in the ND generation. But this is, in my opinion, one of the problems with society as a whole. Is that we're always...
Oh, we're getting serious
here,
huh?
But we're always chasing the newest and the greatest and the flashiest thing. Like, why can't it be enough to just take something that's good and make it the best it can be? right? Why does everything have to have the biggest screens and the most interesting engines and the craziest design? Like, this is a very, what I appreciate about Mazda that they've retained with the Miata is it's like a very 1990s way of developing a car, where you develop the car and then you just make it a little bit better until it's the best product it can possibly be.
Right, so let me give you an example. I think that's a good point you bring up. A good example of a car company that has taken an iconic car and has made it desirable in a lot of different variants is the 911. Mazda basically does like three versions of the Miata, right? There's a Club Sport, there's the regular soft top, and then there's a hard top. Mm-hmm. But if you were to compare that with what Porsche does, right, you've got like the very GT3 RS hardcore track cars, or you've got the very luxurious 911 Targas or convertibles. And I think there's a lesson there for Mazda. They could generate different flavors, different editions of the Miata and bring some more excitement to the brand, and yet still say what I think is important, and that is keep the kind of the core and the DNA of the thing, but yet have different versions and different flavors so that enthusiasts like us would say, hey, that's a really different version of the car I've driven, so maybe I'm really excited by it.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
I mean, Porsche has like 25 variants of a 911.
Right.
Mazda has three variants of a Miata. They could have, you know, a lot more.
Yes, I do agree. Yeah, I think for the most part, that's a good idea. Yeah, for sure.
All right, keep going. What's the next bad one? Give me a bad one.
Well, bad is not the word I would use. Yeah, but this is a car we actually just talked about recently. But for the money, I don't think that the 2024 Land Cruiser is good enough. And what I mean by that is we're talking about a vehicle that realistically starts at about $60,000. And the one you want is the $60,000 one, because otherwise you would buy the GX, like we talked about earlier. But the 1958 version really feels like a $45,000 experience for $60,000.
I actually think it goes deeper than that, Tommy. I think what we're seeing with the Land Cruiser and to some extent even with the Tacoma is there seems to have been a decision made, and I don't know if this is true or not, so don't take this as like gospel, but there seems to have been a decision made at Toyota to sacrifice some of their legendary reliability for more value.
But there's no value.
In terms of what I mean by value is for a lower price point. So like the last Land Cruiser, now we're talking about the American versions. I know if you guys, you know, are like, it's a, you know, it's a Prado, and we get that. We understand where all that comes from in Europe, but we're talking about the American version. So the last Land Cruiser in America, the Heritage Edition, I think that was up to 110,000. Remember?
No, they were like 93, 94.
Okay, so around 100. Give
sure.
Or take. But I think there were markups. Maybe where I'm getting 110 is, I think, beautiful
yeah.
Marking. But anyway, when you bought that, it was this kind of a car that if you were in the know, you knew. So you'd pay a lot for it. You were paying Lexus money for a Land Cruiser. But, you know, that car would easily go a quarter million miles or more. I'm not sure you can say that about the new Land Cruiser. I think that now we've gone more mainstream in some ways, more commercial, and they've lost some of that reliability that was so baked into their most iconic cars. And that's why I think it's still early days. It hasn't been out long enough, but I'm not sure it's going to have that same bulletproof, unstoppable reputation that the old Land Cruiser did. And of course, the price point reflects that, right?
Yeah, but I think the sales also reflect that too. I mean, 200 series Land Cruiser was bulletproof and had that 5.7 V8 and, you know, no hybrid system, no turbocharging, and it would last forever. But the people that complain about the death of the Land Cruiser are also the same people that weren't buying Land Cruisers. The reasons that we didn't
sure
get
that.
The 300 series is because nobody was buying 200 series. They were selling like a few thousand a year
and
in the US.
If you wanted, you can get the Lexus, the LX.
Right, which was actually selling quite well. But very, very, very few people were actually buying 200 series Land Cruisers. So there was no point in doing the 300 in the US. Now this new 250 series makes a lot of sense. It's a little smaller. It's a lot more affordable. It looks a lot cooler. So I think maybe it's lost some of that, you know, panache that you're talking about, but it's gained, I think, a lot of sales for Toyota, which is good, and a lot of capability too. It's a very capable vehicle. I'm not saying it's a bad car. I'm just not sure for the money it's worth it, especially now that we have GX and 4Runner. I'm not sure it really has a place in our market.
And let's talk about the three variants, right? There's the first edition, there's the Land Cruiser, and then there's the 1958 version. What do you think is the sweet spot in those?
Which well, like I said at the start of this car, the 1958 is the one to get.
Yeah.
Because it's the most affordable. You still got the rear locker. But, like, it's a pretty dreary interior. compared to really anything else in that price point. It's pretty down in the dumps there. Powertrain's okay. Space is really good, and the design is really good. I think it's a really good looking car, but that's the GX problem. Just spend a little bit more and get the Lexus, or spend a little bit less and get the 4Runner.
So with the 4Runner, now you're going to have like the cheaper version, the entry level version is going to be the 4Runner, because we've known pricing on that. So we know those are going to start a lot lower than the Land Cruiser. And then if you want to go up, you're going to go to Land Cruiser. And if you really want to go up, you're going to go to the GX. And then if you really want to go up, you're going to go to the LX. That's kind of the pricing strategy, right?
Yep.
I'm dying to get our hands on one again. When we had it, we didn't really have a chance to compare it to some of the other vehicles that we have now in our fleet. And it would be fun to like compare it to the Defender that we have, because price-wise they're very similar, at least if you have the first edition. So our Defender new, the two-door, was $63, and you can get a four-door for probably starting at about $65. So that's where the first edition Land Cruiser is, so they do compete in a lot of ways.
Realistically though, where Land Cruiser tops out is where the Defender begins.
Give or take.
Because like the cheapest Defenders you're going to see in lots are probably going to be $75. New sticker. The super base models are just kind of unobtainium in real life.
Unless you do like we do and buy a used one.
Yeah, and then ours is a two-door, and the Land Cruiser is a four-door, so yeah. Kind of like a different can of worms. But, those are my thoughts on the Land Cruiser.
You know who did a good comparison? Ryan at Driving Sports just compared the Defender, and he did a really good job with that.
Another car that I really liked this year that just totally blew me away, and that is the Lucid Air. Now, we haven't driven the Sapphire, which is the crazy one that everyone's talking about. We drove the Pure and the Grand Touring back-to-back, and what an incredible piece of engineering and design and integration. Some of the tech was, I think, pretty poor on the Lucid Air, but the driving experience of that car is about as close as you can get to levitating as anything I've driven recently. It is so smooth and refined and comfortable and just removes you from the outside world. It's what a Mercedes S-Class probably should be, and it's something that Lucid has nailed.
Yeah. Oh, God. Ugh. So that's a tough one for me. I'll tell you why. We're human, right? And so we like to be treated with the same respect that we would treat somebody else. And as you know, recently Lucid unveiled the Gravity. Our man Zach, who does all of our scheduling of cars, emailed Lucid a whole bunch of times, and all we heard back was crickets. Like nothing. Like, hey, we want to be there when when we have the Gravity unveil. We'd love to drive it. We'd like to present it to you guys. We have a pretty good audience. And they couldn't even reply with an email. Not like, hey, sorry, but we can't accommodate you. Just nothing. And so whenever that happens, I always kind of feel like, if we're not important enough even to get like a reply, then why should we extend the same courtesy to them? And you're right. I love the fact that the Lucid that we had the Grand Touring. And by the way, that car has been out, 2 years? And finally got one. So, it took him 2 years to get us one. Look, and as a human, I understand.
As an automotive journalist,
I know,
you have to separate the two.
I know. I have a hard time with that.
Yeah. And that, I think, is one of, I love you, but that's one of your biggest character flaws.
Fair.
And you have to be able to separate the two. Because just because the PR department doesn't like us, for whatever reason, valid or invalid, the engineers that put that car together did the phenomenal job.
Yes.
They really, really did a good job. And this is something I want to work on in 2025 too, because I can be swayed as well. But when Ford had that situation with us in the Bronco when it came out, it didn't diminish how awesome the Bronco was, right? It diminished maybe our response with the PR team, but the car was freaking awesome. And that's how I kind of feel with Lucid Air. I don't want to be sour grapes on the air because we didn't get a Gravity invite. I don't think that's fair to the company.
It's not that we didn't get a Gravity invite. It's that we asked and they didn't extend the courtesy of a reply. That I thought was...
Yes, and we've had that problem with Lucid many, many times everything.
I completely get that if you're going to unveil a car, you can pick and choose who you want to be there.
Sure.
That's certainly well within your right. And if I were a manufacturer, I would probably pick the people that I thought would be very, nice and gentle and have a huge viewership or were going to be positive. That's fair. But at least say, hey, guys, we don't have room for you. That's all.
Sure. But that aside, That has nothing to do with the Lucid Air.
It has nothing to do with the Lucid Air.
And the Lucid Air was an amazing car. I mean, the range on the Air was, you know, close to 500 miles. And you can get a whole week of driving this car without ever thinking about a charger.
Well, I'll tell you how much I like the Grand Touring. I like the Grand Touring so much that I actually started looking at, you know, doing a long-term review on one and buying one. Mm-hmm. And I found one on one of the websites that was down from like 130,000 to 63,000 with 4,000 miles in 1 year. So basically, it had lost almost 50% of its value in 1 year. And that was the part that actually scared me off. So it was a bargain, but at the same time, I was like, I mean, this thing's depreciating like a rock, as electric cars are.
Yes.
So we're going to take a huge depreciation hit. And unlike, you know, many media companies out there, we like to say we you know, eat what we shoot. So there's no big corporation behind us. There's no, you know, multinational corporation that has these deep pockets. If we can sustain the business model that we have, there's nobody that's going to infuse money. So mm-hmm. we got to be smart about this. And so for that reason, I walked away from it. And I think that's also hurting the brand a lot. I think that's not just me. I think that's anybody out there who thought about buying one.
Well, I mean, basically, it's a half-price car after like a year or two,
yeah.
which is pretty crazy. But that's not necessarily a Lucid problem.
It is a Lucid problem because it goes down to their consumer base. It goes down to the cost of the leases. It cuts right to the quick.
That's an every EV problem.
That is an every EV problem.
It's not specifically unique to Lucid.
True that.
I mean, I was recently shopping for EQS Mercedes. I was curious what they were going for.
Yeah.
Couple of years old, they are now in the 40s, down from like $120,000. You can get one in the $40,000 range, which is insane, and that is an excellent car as well.
You know, I was listening to Matt Farah's podcast,
mm-hmm.
and there's a car that you drove that he was talking about is a good bargain now, and that's the first generation Taycan Cross Turismo.
Yeah, same thing. Uh-oh. Those were also like 130 grand. Now you can get them for like 50 to 60 grand. So really, really crazy depreciation on these EVs. I would never buy one new, but if you can get one like a couple of years old for quarter price, if you can lease one, like I just leased a 500E.
Yeah, let's talk about that. That's kind of the most interesting thing that happened this year. You were able to basically lease a car for the cost of the taxes.
Yeah. So I got, it was a deal that's happening in Colorado only, and you have to be a taxpayer in Colorado. So you can't just fly out here and drive it back. You have to, you know, be registered in Colorado. Is zero down, $0 a month, just pay the taxes on 500Es. The idea being that the dealer makes money from coupons they receive from Stellantis for moving these 500Es off the lot. Car's not selling, there's incentive to do that. And then I would suspect Stellantis makes money on this car because it means they don't have to pay crazy cafe credits and they can keep building and selling inline six-cylinder Rams and diesel Rams, right?
Yeah, so for all of you guys who are out there, like, it's not fair that you're getting, you know, this thing for free. If you're big Hemi fans or if you're big, you know...
Well, Hemi's dead. Hellcat's dead, too.
We'll see. I'm not sure. I think there may be some backtracking.
Look, I will admit, I don't think it's fair. I don't think that there should be these insane Colorado state credits. I don't think there should be insane federal credits. But you can't blame me for taking advantage of something. I'm not breaking any rules. You know, if it was in your state, I'm sure you would as well. I don't think it's necessarily right that, you know, taxpayers are paying for this car, essentially, which in a lot of ways is what's happening.
I actually think it's great because our government is giving massive subsidies to big agriculture, massive subsidies to big oil, and finally we have, you know, money going back to the people who are actually paying the taxes. The problem is we don't see, you know, how much money big oil or big ag or any of the other, you know, big companies that have very expensive lobbyists, you know, get paid. And so that stuff is kind of opaque and invisible. What I think pisses people off is that this is very visible. So your neighbor now knows you've got a brand new car and all you spent was how much?
It was like $1,200. But there's going to be a few hundred dollars in registration fees to get it on the road.
Sure.
So.
But you see what I'm saying? That's very visible. And so I think that's why people...
It's visible. I agree. I still don't think it's fair. I mean, I think if an EV... I'm very free market about this, right? If the car is actually as good as the manufacturers claim it is, it should compete in an open free market with every other car. So I don't think it's fair, but I also think I would be kind of silly in my position to not take advantage of this and save $200 a month in gas, which is what my wife is spending on her Land Rover right now. So the car's fine. I think it's fun. I think it's adorable. I think it's outrageously priced. For the sticker's $34,000.
Yeah, it's crazy.
But I don't think it's like a particularly good car. I get the sense that there's going to be a lot of quality issues with this machine.
And the great thing is you don't have to worry about that because
it's under
warranty.
Yeah, but like it still would suck to have this, you know, car we're excited about and then it has charging issues, which it's already having, and then it has to go to the dealer.
And then you don't have use of it.
And then you don't have use of it, and then we're just paying gas for another gas car. So even at a free car, I think it's cool, well, and I'm excited about it.
Don't get too, like, bummed out. I mean, what happened was you were charging it, and it stopped charging for no reason.
Yes, but it happens sporadically and randomly.
Okay. Have you changed chargers?
No, I have not changed chargers.
Well, try that. See if that does any good. This isn't fast charging.
This is just at-home charging.
Yeah.
And the app is pretty funny to use because it's very dreadful. But I am excited that we are saving all this money. I'm really excited about that. My wife has been driving it every day, and she seems to like it because it's really zippy. And I think it's cute. I think it's a pretty cool little car. I don't think we're really going to save that much money in the long term because insurance on it's kind of really expensive because it's got to be full comprehensive. But, it's an interesting little experiment.
And I think whenever the government puts its finger on the scale, which it's doing more and more often nowadays, I think it just creates these weird imbalances in the market, right?
Well, I just wish they wouldn't do any of it.
I agree, but if the government refuses to not do any of it, then if they do it and there's something that finally regular people can take advantage of, if you don't happen to own General Dynamics, then, you know, I'm all about taking advantage of it.
The interesting thing is, so our Boulder Nissan dealer now has a deal for, it's like $1,200 down, $5 a month on lease. Mm. We have one outside that we
pay $9. $9. I feel like, oh my God.
Ripped off. And their entire lot is Leafs now.
Yeah.
I mean, it is insane. Like, they used to have a good mix of Sentras and Altimas and Rogues, and now it's like they have so many Leafs, they are parking them on the grass. There's probably 70 Leafs in a standard car parking lot. All base models, all gray, blue, or silver. And that's how they're making a few hundred, they're making
they're
like
dumping,
$600.
They're dumping Leafs on our little communities.
They're making like $600 a Leaf, and now every car in Boulder is a Leaf.
So here's an interesting question, okay?
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
So one of the reasons they can do that is because in Colorado, we also get $5,000 from the state.
Yeah.
So basically, the reason you've got such a good deal is because you can take the 7.5 federal and then add the $5,000 to it, and you've got $12,500 that comes right off the sticker or is included in the Leaf that the dealer and the manufacturer can back on that car.
Sure.
So if you've got a bunch of Fiat 500Es that you've built, and we know this because the plant in Italy had to stop producing them because they overbuilt them, then what are you going to do with them, right? Dump them in Colorado, take the money from the government, and you know, mark them down on your books as a sale versus as a losing asset, depreciating asset. So that makes perfect sense to me. And for us, it's not to take advantage of it. And I get that you feel like this is unfair. Would be silly.
No, I agree. I'm not saying I'm upset. I'm very happy I could take advantage of it.
And
just saying I understand the viewer's resentment when they say they feel like they're paying for my car, which may or may not be true.
Well, if you live in Colorado, you probably are.
Yeah, which is, I think is a problem. But you can't blame me for taking advantage of it because it's crazy.
All right, so let me ask you this. Okay, the conventional wisdom, of course, is, and Mr. President Trump has stated this, that he will cut the federal subsidies for both electric cars, that $7,500 is gone, and for the charging network, which is also gone. And so the conventional wisdom is that that will kill the electric car in America.
Yeah.
Do you think that's going to happen?
Yeah, I think we're going to see a big reduction in sales.
I'm not sure about that because here's the thing.
It took dealers literally giving Fiat 500Es away for them to move off the lots. That's how few people want these cars. At least in the Fiat 500.
But I would argue, okay.
Arias in Colorado are $59 a month.
Really? Zach wants one.
Yeah. He was the one telling me about the deal. They're like $59 a month.
Here's the thing, though. I think it's like a gateway drug. So there are a lot of people who won't even give an EV a chance because of the fact that they have range anxiety, or they've, you know, heard or read things that may or may not be true, or they're conservative in the truest sense that they don't like change, right? The change going from internal combustion. But as a gateway drug, once you actually have an EV as a city car, now I'm not talking about like road tripping it, it actually is pretty darn good, right?
If
you're zipping around town, running errands, basically, you know, if you're charging it at home, if you have that luxury, you're running around for 10% of what it would cost you. You never have to go to the gas station. And as an around-the-town car, it just works really well. It's not a great enthusiast car right now, for the most part. It's certainly not a great value because they're depreciating like rocks. But in your case, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Because you're not going to take the depreciation. You're going to give the thing back after 2 years. And I think once you actually get very skeptical people to actually try an EV, be it a Leaf and a Fiat 500, which are not the best of electric cars by any stretch of the imagination, maybe they will actually overcome some of that initial resistance and see that they actually, in a lot of, I'll give you a concrete example why I like electric cars. So,
all know you like electric cars, Dad. We don't need more.
No. I also like Hellcats and TRXs.
Sure.
We just bought a G63 with 560 horsepower. That sounds incredible. I love all cars. So to me, what powers them isn't what makes them, like, defined politically. To me, it's just, you know, how they work in my life. So we have this i8, which is a plug-in hybrid.
Sure.
And I drive it around town. I run my errands in it. And I like the fact that it doesn't shift, and it's very quiet, and then it's really zippy. But it only has like 20 miles of range. Mm-hmm. So there's a big thing that happens after 20 miles of range, and then it shifts to being a gas engine powered car. And around town, I like the EV much more than I like the gas powered car. Once I'm on the highway, once I'm road tripping, then I want the gas powered car. But just for running around errands, I love the thing. It's quieter. There's none of that like herky jerkiness from shifting for the most part. It just is very silent, and it's very, very cool to zip around in that thing on electric mode.
Why are we doing this?
I don't know.
Why, like, these people have already made up their minds who are listening to this podcast.
True, I keep going.
So why are we convincing people one way or another?
I can't convince them.
Yeah, so I just think, like, we're using up time here.
All right, let's keep going.
So the next car on my list, which I actually liked quite a bit, was the new Honda Civic Hybrid.
Oh, I love that car. Love that car.
I don't think you've driven it yet.
I have driven it. Not the new, not the 2025.
Yeah, so this is...
I drove the regular Civic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love the regular Civic. Make it a hybrid.
Yeah, it's really, really good.
Planetary gear set, right? It doesn't have it's like an eCVT, not a CVT.
Yeah, so this car I drove in Montreal.
Yeah.
And the reason I like it is because it's not far off the performance of the standard Civic Si, actually. But you get a lot better efficiency. It's really nice to drive. And I think
50 miles of range?
No.
Of fuel economy?
Yeah. It's not a plug-in hybrid.
Right.
It's not as efficient as like a Prius, but it's very seamless in its interaction.
And it's actually fun to drive.
Yeah, it's very fun to drive. It's really good
Prius
value.
Prius looks like it's fun to drive.
Yes.
Not so.
Prius is pretty fun to drive. The new one actually is okay. But the Civic Hybrid is just a much better handling machine. It's pretty decent value. You get a really good interior, really good build quality. It looks pretty good. It's very useful. I really like the new Civic Hybrid.
Yeah, I completely agree. I love the regular Civic, and if they made it more fuel efficient and haven't lost the edge of its kind of fun to drive. And the great thing about the Civic is it's gotten much bigger. Let's face it. When I had the first CVCC, now I'm dating myself, that thing was a little teeny tiny car that was like made of tinfoil. Kind of like the Fiat 500 behind you, a little bit bigger than that. But the new Civic is like when I was in high school, bigger than the Accord back then. You know, so I love the fact that it's so utilitarian. I love that honeycomb design on the inside. I think they just nailed it in every way that they could. And Honda, if you're listening, we would love to get the new hybrid for a long-term loan because I think it's going to be one of the kind of classics, future classics, collectible classics from 2025.
I don't think so.
I think so.
I don't think so. Okay. It's a very good utilitarian car. I don't think it's going to be a classic, but
let me give you why I think that, because it's not, I have reasons for this. All right. Do you know what's a collectible classic right now?
What?
For my Preludes.
Yeah, but Preludes were two-door sports cars. This is a four-door sedan.
I'm not sure they were sports cars. But they were I lived through that era.
Yeah,
they were sporty.
And they were sporty and they looked cool. And like the Civic Hybrid is not really in that same vein.
It's pretty sporty.
You know what's in the same vein as the Prelude?
What?
The new Prelude.
Yeah, the new Prelude just came out. It's going to have
so fake. That's going to be a collectible. I don't think the Civic Hybrid is per se going to be a collectible.
It's going to have fake shifting.
That's fine. But I think that the new Civic Hybrid is just an excellent daily driver, good value, really, really good car.
Anyway, Honda, we would love to have it for a long-term review. It's one of the cars I'm most excited about.
All right, next up, we've got this is a car that was not very good. I actually don't think it was as bad as the initial review said it was, but it's the VinFast VF8, which is a Vietnamese car that's being sold in the U.S., although I have yet to see one on the road other than this one I drove. And
thanks to our friend Kyle. Thank you, Kyle, for lending it to us.
Yeah, and actually, I didn't hate it as much as I thought I would because all the reviews were diabolical when the car came out. It was actually pretty comfortable, pretty quick, pretty refined, nice interior. The tech was okay. It was very glitchy still, even after a couple years of development.
I might give that the most improved category.
Yeah, I think it wasn't nearly as bad as the world would say it was.
Initially, it was really bad.
The problem is that I think the car is going to really struggle in the market because it was tainted from that launch.
I agree.
And once that train is going in that direction, it's very hard to spin around.
You got like one chance to make a first impression, and if that first impression is bad, it takes years, if not decades. Same, you can see that in Kia and Hyundai, right? Hyundai and Kia are just knocking them out of the ballpark one after another, and yet a lot of people to this day think of them as just like very inexpensive. Very tinny cars that you buy if your credit's bad, and that nothing could be further from the truth with the new Kia Hyundais, especially the Genesis brand.
So I did like that VinFast more than I thought I was going to like that VinFast, and I just it was still a bad car. Like I'm not going to say it's on the same level as a Model Y or a Aria or a Mach-E. It still has a lot of improvement to do in some of the interfaces that you do with it. Like some of the tech glitches I had were pretty wild. But I will say it is not that bad of a car. So that was kind of a surprise this
year. Can I give you, are you still going or can I give you some of mine?
Well, yeah, you can do. I've got a bunch more here though.
Okay, let me give you I'll give you a couple trends that I love. I'll give you two trends. I'll give you a trend that I love and a trend that I hate.
Okay.
And then I'll give you examples of cars that represent that.
Okay.
Which one do you want, the hate or the love?
The love first.
So, you can kind of ask yourself the question, what's the difference between a plug-in hybrid and an extended range vehicle, right? An EREV.
Range extended vehicle.
Yeah. And the difference is really the size of the battery, right? And the size of the motor.
Yeah. I mean, a plug-in hybrid, the way I would describe it is a range extended vehicle is an electric car that has a backup generator. A plug-in hybrid vehicle is a vehicle that has two powertrains that you can run on independently.
I mean, both have two powertrains.
Sure, but a range extended vehicle is primarily an EV.
But they're kind of like two ends of the same, bookends of the same
they're
shelf.
They're related, sure.
Yeah. The trend that I love right now is the trend of plug-in hybrids. Now, we have not had many range extenders to test. We had the Volt, which is sort of kind of a range extender, and we had the i3, which we owned.
i3 was,
and that was not great.
The difference in my mind between a range extended vehicle and a plug-in hybrid vehicle, as the state of California would agree with me, by the way, for a period there, is a range extended vehicle has to go further on electricity than it can go on gasoline.
Yeah.
A Volt can only do 40 miles on electricity, and then it's got a gasoline.
So, I mean, i3 is the only one we've really had a real
that's
experience.
That's really been the only production range extender.
And the problem with that one was that with the range extender, it could only kick on after the battery was completely depleted, and then it could not generate enough power to actually get that thing up to highway speed.
But that's kind of, at least up until this point, that's kind of one of the sacrifices with the range extender.
And you drove the BYD Shark.
Yes.
Which is also a range extender.
I don't know. But
you're proving my point. I mean, it's a spectrum.
Yeah, it's a spectrum.
Anyway, so I love that trend. I think initially when these plug-in hybrids or range extenders came out, every journalist was like, why do you want two powertrains?
Sure.
You know, it's two things that could go wrong, two things you have to maintain. And there was a lot to that argument. But I think over time we found out that it's a convenient solution to a problem.
Yeah.
It gets rid of range anxiety if you're afraid of that. It creates the opportunity to cross country without having to rely on our, let's say, questionable charging network. So there's a lot of upsides to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I love that I love that trend. And my favorite examples of that, and I've been lucky enough to drive these two, so I'm going to kind of be like name dropping here, so I apologize, but I do love this. The new Lamborghini Urus SE, which is a plug-in hybrid with 789 horsepower. Talk about using two powertrains to its maximum benefit.
Okay.
And then, of course, the Revuelto, which is basically the same thing, except that one has a V10, 1,000 horsepower plug-in hybrid. Mm. And I love the fact that you can now kind of have your cake and eat it too. So if you want this very powerful car, and if you just want to like the eye, you know, putt around town in it, especially like the Urus, I think it gets like, I want to say it's like 50 kilometers or maybe more, 60 kilometers. When I was there, they didn't yet have the U.S. numbers for it, the EPA numbers. But like, you know, when we had the original Urus, I always felt bad because you're just like, you're like sucking so much gas that you look at the fuel gauge and you're like, oh my God, as much as I love driving this thing, it's so thirsty. And now you've kind of solved that problem. So that's the trend that I love. The trend that I hate, and I'll give you examples of that, is kind of I call it the Teslification of cars. Now, Tesla wasn't the first one to do this, but of course, now everybody's jumped on the bandwagon. And there's a couple things about this that I absolutely hate, and that is getting rid of every button in the car.
Yes, that's terrible.
I mean, you know, and then not just getting rid of every button, but going to haptic controls, just, you know, taking this minimalist design and then using it, because initially, it was like a minimalist design. People were like, oh, that's really cool, right? We're cleaning up the interior. But now it's become a cost-cutting thing. Like a good example of that is next to you in our, look at that, a little ID Buzz. That's the old one there next to you. And, of course, it only has two switches for four windows. Why? Right? Did Volkswagen run out of switches?
Well, yeah, that's just stupid.
Yeah, and probably the height of that trend that I hate, this is the example of the car, is the Polestar 4, where they got rid of the rear window, you know, and replaced it with a camera.
Right.
I mean, imagine, flip it on its head. Imagine if for the last 100 years, cars didn't have rear windows, right? They were just covered up. And then somebody comes along and puts a window back there, right? Everybody would be like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing since, you know, sliced bread. I can see out the back. And yet we've gone the exact opposite way. And I'm seeing it also came out in the new Jaguar, also no rear window, the new concept that they came out with. And it just seems like the designers all call each other up and they try to outcool each other.
Well, the era of car we're entering, which I hear a lot now at these press trips, is something called the software-defined vehicle, where the experience is driven not by an engine or by a suspension design.
Not by a Hemi.
Or by an experience, but by software, right?
Yeah.
And we're seeing this more and more. I think it's awful. I agree with you completely. I really hate the idea of a software-defined vehicle, because if I wanted a software-defined vehicle, I would use a phone and a bus pass. That's kind of how I feel about that.
Another good example of that is that Tesla cab, right, that they just unveiled.
Well, that's a full autonomous vehicle.
Right, but definitely it's software not defined. It's software everything.
Yes.
Right? But why would you create a cab with only two seats?
Because I think most cabs probably only hold. I mean, like if you look at
I get that. I'm sure there's somebody who has a spreadsheet that says 90% of cab rides are only one person, and so why do we need four seats?
Right.
And yet, in my mind, it just seems back-ass, because there will come a time when you will want to take your friends.
Well, then you'll use a bigger one.
There's no bigger one. There's only one.
Yeah,
it's a two-seater.
At some point, like if I go on Uber, right, if it's just me and you, I would just use an Uber. If it was me, you, and Mom, I would use an Uber XL, right? So this is probably the first version, and Tesla has shown a larger version.
But by that logic, all cars should only be three-seaters.
Well, that probably would be better.
You see what I'm saying?
I mean, the problem is...
And the problem is people don't buy cars for what they use them for. They buy cars for what they think they're going to use them
for. But you're not buying this car.
Well, you're leasing them, whatever.
But you're going to be using it as a taxi cab.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really matter what it looks like.
Yeah, I'm giving that the biggest thumb down of the year, because that whole business strategy to me seems so backwards, right, from everything I know about human nature, that you're gonna lease a car that's gonna drive around at night and, you know, make money for you. I think I have a friend who tried that on Turo, ended very badly.
Well, the problem is, I do think that's really stupid, but I do understand where they are coming from, and that.
Well, I get where they're coming from. I think it's just a completely wrong-headed
place. No, but if you look at the size of the car, why does anybody need a 9,500-pound Hummer EV? You know, why is it that the typical one-person U.S. commuter now, especially in the EV space, is some 7,000-pound SUV?
Why does anybody need a burka bag that costs $50,000?
Yeah, but I think
that's... You see, the problem is that's the way human nature is. It's not what people need or, you know, what people have in the day. It's what people want.
At some point, I mean, and this is an economics problem, too. Like, is it up to the manufacturer to decide what people want, or is it up to people to change their buying habits, right?
Well, you could try to change people's buying habits, and you're going to go quickly bankrupt because this all has been established, right? Where, I mean, Tesla thinks it's literally reinventing the wheel, and I know I come across as an old curmudgeon when I look at, like, the steering wheels that are in the new cars, and they're squircles, and they're all these weird shapes, and I'm like, some things have just been perfected. And, you know, you were talking about this kind of, right? You're not going to make a steering wheel better by making it square, round, half round.
That's not what I'm arguing, though.
But that's what they're doing with these cars. They're saying we could make a better taxi by making it a two-seater. And I'm like, there's a reason taxis are four-seaters.
But ignore the taxi for a sec, right? All these new, and especially we see it especially problematic in the EV world coming out, are these just enormously bloated SUVs that are so heavy, right? And so needlessly large. Why is it that half the vehicles I see running around Boulder are Rivian R1T or R1S?
Because that's what people want.
Yeah, but why?
I mean, now you sound
like the best-selling car.
Now you sound like the government telling people what they need, right? Because
but at some point, shouldn't the vehicle manufacturers feel some responsibility when 7,000 pounds of Rivian barrels into a Prius and takes out an entire family?
Well, in America, the way you solve that is by having, you know, a boatload of attorneys who sue each other's pants off. But I grew up in the Czech Republic where the government dictated basically by 5-year plans of what people should drive.
I'm not saying that then.
And you end up with a Trabant.
Yeah, I don't think that's a solution. I just think we as a whole, as a society, should probably think long and hard about, you know, this excess that we're seeing so much in the automotive space.
Yeah, I'm not saying that the human brain is wired to be like, I mean, what you're describing is basically communism, right? Communism was the idea that we'll all, as a society, move forward for the best of the society by putting out these 5-year plans. And we've tried that experiment. And what ended up happening with that experiment is that it failed miserably because people aren't motivated by what's good for the society. People are motivated by what's good for them and what they want.
You're not listening to what I'm saying. I'm not voting for communism. I think that's a terrible plan. I'm not voting for government interaction.
Well, you wouldn't vote for communism.
No.
It would be thrust
exactly.
upon you.
Exactly. I think that's all a terrible plan. I just think that it's a problem that I can't buy a $20,000 Volkswagen Beetle that gets 50 miles per gallon, that seats 2 people comfortably, 4 people in a pinch. But I can buy a $72,000.
Well, you kind of got that with the 500E.
Yeah, which is why we raised 500E.
Yeah.
But... like, why can't I? Why is it I don't have the option for an affordable Volkswagen Beetle? Instead, I have to buy this 6,000-pound monster van. I really wish that Volkswagen would have prioritized affordability and simplicity.
Well, so the other thing that happens is if you start to mandate.
I'm not mandating anything.
I'm not saying you should, but
I'm saying mandates are not.
Let's say that you're some government official, which is happening in Europe right now, right? This is happening in Europe. And this, the result of that is, I'll give you the result of it. So in Europe, you're sitting there in Brussels, and you're like, people are dying.
Yes.
And so what we can do is we can put this ding into every car that if you exceed the speed limit, it will ding at you incessantly.
Right.
And eventually where that's going to go is it won't allow the car to exceed the speed limit. Right. That's where that's going. And Europeans, for the most part, go along with that. Why they do? Because maybe they're more rule followers than we are in America when you try to do that thing. There's 2 things that happen. People get super pissed off. We saw it with electric cars, and they go the exact opposite way, right? They're like, you're going to take my Hemi out of my cold, dead hands. Or there's a secondary business that develops around it, basically figuring out ways to defeat these devices.
Sure.
Which I applaud.
Once again, not for regulation in that sense. But I just wish there were more options on the market that were good, small, fun, affordable, lightweight, utilitarian cars.
All right, let's keep going on our list. I appreciate your point of view.
Yeah, I mean, I think
Before we're almost out of time.
One of the cars I drove this year that I really liked along that standpoint was actually the new 2025 Volkswagen Jetta. It's a really good car. And it was affordable. It's comfortable.
I haven't driven the Jetta in like 5 years.
The changes were really good.
Yeah. I didn't even know they were making the Jetta, to be honest.
Yeah. And the GLI is the last Volkswagen that will be sold in the U.S. with the manual transmission, which is sad.
A shame, yeah.
But once again, going back to that kind of just basic, simple.
But here's the thing on the Jetta. I love the GLI. I love the manual. But that was the car that when I was your age, I would have lusted after. My generation, right? The GTI, the Jetta. All those cars, all those manual cars when I was young, that's the cars that I always wanted. But it seems like your generation now is more into technology than into like a good old manual. I'm not saying you are. I'm just saying your generation.
That's why we're seeing the software-defined vehicle.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, speaking of cars that are too heavy and bloated that I wouldn't buy, but I did love, is the Hyundai Ioniq 5N.
Yeah, what a great car.
So really interesting car.
Too expensive.
A little bit too expensive, but the simulated gear shift in that car, which I thought was going to be really dumb and corny and cheesy, was actually excellent.
So we're looking at a car that's over 60,000.
Yeah, but it 0 to 60 in 3.2 seconds.
Yeah, first, I mean, Hyundai cracked the code there. I would say it's the first electric car that's fun to drive.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I drove that to our test track. Loved it both on the track and off the track.
Mm-hmm.
Really enjoyed my time in it. And I think, I'm hoping that is a trend that other manufacturers will pick up on, right? Like, forget the stupid trend of making every door handle disappear into the side of the car. Why don't you kind of copy the trend of fake shifts or internal? I think. Let me ask you this, okay? Here's a question for you. You just drove the new Charger.
Yes.
And it's got that Fragonix exhaust, right?
Yes.
Which is basically an amplified speaker underneath the car that it simulates exhaust notes.
Yes.
Now, Hyundai did the same thing with the N, but they only played that note. You don't have to have it. You can turn it off inside the car.
Right.
Was that the way to go?
I mean, I don't think it has to do inside versus outside of the car.
Okay.
I think it has more to do with how you interact with it. Because one of the things that was key that made the Hyundai system work really well and the Charger Daytona be a little bit annoying is that in the Hyundai, not only is it an audible sound, but there is a G-force involved and there is an interaction involved with pulling the paddle shift and feeling that change in acceleration. The Charger Daytona was more annoying than anything because it kind of sounded like a V8 CVT that you had no interaction with other than just a speaker blaring exhaust sound out. So it wasn't.
So what you're saying is that Hyundai did a better job of faking the noise inside than Dodge did of faking the noise outside.
Well, the Dodge is inside and outside.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know.
You hear it on the outside, and it's very, very loud.
Are you saying you don't like the band versus the fact that they're playing music either in an indoor venue or an outdoor venue? So are you saying that...
That has no impact on it for me.
So I'm saying you don't care that it's both inside and outside.
No, I mean,
it doesn't sound natural. It doesn't sound right.
There's no other way to experience the Charger Daytona except for that exhaust sound.
And you can turn it off, too.
Yeah, which you can. Whereas on the Hyundai, the experience is more tactile. It's not just audible. It's like the difference between listening to a band and playing in a band.
Mm.
Yes, you can listen to a band and it will be very nice, but playing in the band is a whole other world.
Because you can control the shift points,
yeah.
So you're controlling that.
Yeah, you are in control of the experience versus the experience just being presented to
you. That's a great distinction, Tommy.
So that was another car I didn't like very much, the Charger Daytona. It's not as bad as some people will have you say it is. I actually thought that the interior build quality was excellent. Interior was really nice.
I heard the design is excellent.
Really beautiful.
It's got a lot of road presence.
Yeah, tons of space in the trunk. I think it's too slow if they're going to call it the ultimate muscle car. Mm-hmm. You can't have 0 to 60 in 4.7 seconds.
You can't have a Tesla Model 3 that's going to...
Even the scat pack's too slow.
That's going to, you know, take
expensive.
You out on the drag strip.
I think that's actually like the driving experience, in my opinion, was pretty good. Like, I know some people had complaints about like the one pedal. I actually thought it was pretty well programmed. I thought it worked pretty well. I just think that for the value there, for $80,000, it needs to be faster. It needs to have more... more of everything, to be honest. More charging, more range, more power, more everything for $80,000. But the car is pretty cool. I think people should give it a chance. I just think it was a little disappointing relative to the price point.
Okay, any other cars?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
what else you got?
The car that was both up and down for me was the Hyundai Santa Fe, which is the new boxy looking three row from Hyundai. What is up and down is I think certain trims are very good and certain trims are very disappointing. Like if you want a stylish, large, call anything SUV, the standard Santa Fe is awesome. If you get the XRT with the expectation it's going to be off-road, off-roady, it's not very good off-road. So that one's very dependent on use case for me, but it can be a really good vehicle or really disappointing based on the situation. And then I know I was complaining about it earlier, but probably my favorite car of the year is the ID. Buzz, the Volkswagen.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Because,
I'll tell you why. Okay. I did a lot of thinking about this. So obviously, if you guys haven't seen it, I road tripped it from our great friends at Garnet VW in Reading, Pennsylvania. Probably the best car buying experience I've ever had. So if you're listening to this and you want an ID. Buzz, give Steve a call over at their dealership. I think they still have a couple left. Just a wonderful group, you know, of people. And we're not getting paid for this. We're not. There's no promotional, no sponsorship. But just look. It took me. Here's the greatest thing about it. It took me 30 seconds to sign all the paperwork, and they had cheesesteaks for me after I was done.
Nice.
A lot of that probably has to do with us being TFL, but still. I was very grateful, and they didn't have to do it. I've had horrible experiences at dealerships being TFL, so let's put that out there. But I think I figured out why I love the ID. Buzz. So I had this horrible experience. It doesn't have enough range for a road trip.
Right.
But, you know, remember the old Subaru, slogan? Cheap and cheerful? You remember that?
Yeah, it was cheap and ugly.
Oh, cheap and ugly? I thought it was cheap and cheerful. But what I love about that car is that it's cheerful. It just puts me in a good mood. Whenever I see it, whenever I drive it, whenever I'm in it, it just makes me feel happy.
I like it because it's very different than anything on the road. It offers an experience unlike any new car, except for maybe the Cybertruck, which is also an experience, but maybe a very different experience. But it feels super unique, which is something that we are lacking in a lot of the new car industry, and that's why I like it. It's a good design. It makes people happy when they see it. It's super practical. It's too expensive, and the range is not good enough. But as a thing to drive around in, it is an excellent user experience, which is different than just like getting in a Model Y and going down the road in another electric pod. It doesn't feel like another electric pod. It feels like a practical, interesting. It's very difficult to do a vehicle that's designed in such a way that it makes people stop and take a picture, but also can carry six people and do that very quietly and comfortably. I mean, usually those two are mutually exclusive. That's always been kind of some of the magic in the bus, is it's a personality play, but it's also practical.
I think they captured it.
Yeah.
I think they got the magic.
It's too expensive. Yeah. I mean, and the range isn't good enough, and I wish you could get just a small gasoline version would be cool.
Yeah, we talked about that with me and Cole. We were road tripping, and if they had
one of those gas version for $45,000,
like stick that 2-liter they have in the GTI.
Yes, that would be really, really cool. But I've still got to commend them for coming out with it. And then my favorite car of the year, which no one's going to care about, but I absolutely loved, is in something you were talking about earlier. Two favorites. Second favorite for me, Volvo V60 Polestar.
Yeah, you love that thing.
Plug-in hybrid station wagon. It was fast. It was comfortable. It was practical. It was so good.
Your wife did not love it.
Well, she didn't like the yellow seatbelts, and she thought it was kind of stiff, which is true. But from a car guy standpoint, that checked all of my boxes. Low, fast, sleek.
I'm with you.
It was efficient. I mean, it was so good.
My favorite car of the year is also a station wagon.
What's that?
I'll give you a couple. So this is my favorite dream car of the year. Fell in love with the plug-in hybrid BMW M5 Touring. First time they've ever brought the station wagon version to United States. For $125,000, you can kind of get it with everything.
Yeah.
And would love to get one for a long-term review. Seriously thought about buying it, but we just don't have the views nor the budget for a $125,000 car. So it would be certainly something that, you know, I would love to own. But it's very expensive, and everybody, it's funny because I'm kind of contrarian. All the journalists hate it because it's so heavy, but I love the fact that it's a plug-in hybrid. I love the fact that it has 700 horsepower, you know, and I love the fact that it actually has room for your family and your dog. Right. And you can actually, like Blaze, right? Blaze, we have all these tall off-roaders, can't get into them. This thing, boop, you just jump right into it. Same thing with the Polestar. I'm sorry, the Volvo.
Yeah.
The Polestar Volvo.
It was a Polestar Volvo.
Okay, yeah. Well, and I'll give you my other ones. But you go next. And I'll give you my affordable, the one that I could actually afford.
My favorite car I drove all year was, and you didn't like this thing at all, but I like this car for the same reason I like the ID. Buzz, in that it offers an experience no other car offers, and that is the INEOS Grenadier. So we had one start of the year. I absolutely adored that vehicle. So
we got that one wrong. You know, there's this kind of this wave that happens when people realize what a vehicle is, especially a new vehicle that's never been out. And so we bought it too early, and I completely agree with you. We sold it too early, and we missed the wave. So it took maybe like 6 months longer for people to start to realize that these things were out there and become interested in them. So when we had ours, nobody, unless you were a hardcore off-roader, knew what they were, and we sold it before people did decide. So I think we got that guy wrong.
But that was awesome. I really like that a lot. I also have fallen completely in love with the two-door Defender that the company has purchased. That thing is just incredible. I also really like our two-door cheap Jeep. That is a very capable vehicle that I think proves you don't need an expensive Jeep. That's been a highlight for me. So those are some of the top hits and some of the misses of the year.
I'm looking at this list. Another one that I would love, and I know I'm gravitating toward the expensive ones, but the Lamborghini Urus SE, just fell in love with it. I got to go take it off-road, Tommy. Got to go whip it around a dirt course. I'll give you the one that got away, the Mercedes, that everybody's now finally in California taking off-road and wrecking, but I think we got to get our hands on a G-Wagon, the electric one. I think we, you know, because I don't think anybody does off-road reviews like we do.
But they're not going to have off-road tires on it.
They're all they on don't like have 22s. Off-road tires.
So it's kind of like...
I know, but that's the one I think we could really do justice for.
Yeah, but
Mercedes
has
the budget to put off-road tires on the
thing. I know, but I just like, it's like putting Mike Tyson in stilettos. You know, it's a very capable vehicle, but without the right rubber, it's not going to be very good. So, folks, let us know what you think in the comment section below of the cars we drove this year, what your opinions are on some of our controversial matters. And this has been another TFL Car Podcast.
Yeah, thank you for listening and for watching. Really appreciate the fact that you guys have hung with us all year. And really appreciate you guys, because without you, there's no reason to do this. So thank you for putting up with our bickering.
Yep.
Thank you for putting up with my soapboxing.
Yep.
Others would call it ranting, Tommy.
Yes, for sure.
And we'll see you around next time. Remember, where should they go?
All TFL if you want to find more podcasts.
Take care. Ciao.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.